Hey guys, I'm Tom Ferry and I'm the CEO and founder of Stakester, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story, and every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Before we jump into this week's episode, make sure to visit thestartupstory.co/your story and submit your story for consideration for a future episode. We're always looking for an incredible founder story and one that most people might not have heard, and it might very well be yours. Now, we can't guarantee that just because you submit at thestartupstory.co/your story that your story will be selected for an episode, but it is absolutely the best possible way to submit your story for consideration. Now, let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Tom Ferry, the founder of Stakester. Stakester is an entertainment platform that allows e-gamers a platform to add some monetary pride to the online gaming community. Through their use of proprietary technology, they are able to be your third partner to any gaming challenge to ensure payouts are handled correctly. Picture you and I out there playing some basketball. I think I'm a hot shot. I want to put some money on the line. And I'm going to say I'm good for a 10th spot on this. And you say, James, I could probably beat you. I'm good for a 10th spot as well. Well, Stakester would be like that third person there, taking our money, holding it for us until the challenge is over. And upon completion, the winner gets that money. Now, you might be asking, how does it do that for online gaming? And we cover that in this episode because it's quite remarkable the technology they're using to accomplish this. Now, the technology itself is really cool, but the fact that Stakester was born out of a situation where Tom got cheated from some winnings while sparring with a massive Russian is what makes this entrepreneurial journey truly dynamic. To add even more value to the episode, Tom shares how he utilized a cold email strategy to his fundraising efforts, and that cold email strategy resulted in him raising £400,000, or for my US listeners, about $550,000, out of a £500,000 round. Yes, you heard me correctly. He raised over $500,000 using a cold email outreach tactic. And he shares that tactic in this episode, so make sure you listen through. This episode has some tremendous learnings for all of us. But like all great stories, we need to start at the very beginning.
I grew up in an academic household, right? So both my parents, teachers and academics, my brother, super nerd, maths and physics geek. And so I was the outlier, right? Because I was interested in sports and drama. And, you know, like when you're at school, being into sport and drama is a recipe for let's get teased. And what I realized, I think like people say, like, do you have an entrepreneur mindset? I always think it's really interesting. And I think actually, no, I don't. I don't have an entrepreneur mindset. What I do have is a team building mindset. I always say to people, like, I always think of myself as a collector of talent. So when I was a kid, I was always really keen to find out like who was the best at a particular sport, and I wanted to train with those guys. Like when I was playing rugby and stuff, I was always trying to find like what's the best team. I want to be on that team. I'm heavily into my martial arts, and I was like, where's the best martial arts? Which one's winning all the titles? I want to be in that. Which drama society is the one smashing it? I want to be there. I got that because I think obviously I'm just trying to stand out in front of my parents because they're the academics. I'm like, yeah, but look at me.
Yeah.
I'm winning over here. And then I discovered something quite young, which was, I realized like when you're a kid, I did well at school, and the career options available to you are accountant, investment banker, you know, things like that. And I discovered selling really early on.
Okay.
I discovered this as a thing because I went on work experience, and I come from an island at the bottom of the UK called the Isle of Wight, which has a population of like 100,000. It's super sparse. Okay. It's like everyone there's 100,000 years old. It's old people. Like, you know, there's no industry there apart from tourism. And I went up to the Big Smoke, up into London, and I went on this work experience. And there's a guy there, and his name was Nick Hucker. And he used to go to these meetings with all these big companies. And he had a really fancy apartment and a fancy car. And, you know, he had a really, really, really fit girlfriend. You know, and I was like, this guy is a king. And I remember thinking when I was with him, I was just like, what does he actually do? Like, he just goes to these meetings and talks about product. And he's like, oh, I'm an account man. And I'm like, what's an account man? And he's like, I sell to people. And I was like, isn't selling like door-to-door salesman. He goes, no. I sell the big stuff. And then I realized all of a sudden, like, this was a career. Yeah. Like, it didn't matter what you were doing. It's just, this is selling. And, like, he had, you know, when I got, I'd also did work at a couple of accountancy firms as work experience. And I was like, this is so boring. Like, this guy was going to see me all the time. And so I was like, this is the dream for me. And so I was like, when I went to university, like, I want to work in sales. I want to work in sales. I don't know what I want to sell, but I want to work in sales. And that was really the big influence for me, because I realized even then, like, I was already selling. I wanted to be captain of my teams at school. So I just sold to the coach. Just like, yeah, I'm the guy. Get me in. I'm the guy. I can make this team get somewhere. I can turn this from A to B, and I can get the dream. And that was selling the dream then. And then, like, when I was trying to get, you know, my show on the stage at school, I'd be selling to the teachers, be like, yeah, this is what we should be doing. And that was really what got me into it. So, yeah, I think I'm just a sales guy and a team builder. Like, an entrepreneur for me is a problem solver. A guy sees a problem in the world and wants to solve it. And I think I have that, but it's not my core passion. I haven't seen a problem in the world and thought, I need to fix it in the same way. What I've done is I've seen something that I'm passionate about, and I know I can find the people who can fix it, because I know that I like to build teams.
You know, it's interesting, and I want to jump around a little bit. Usually we kind of continue on the life journey to see all the breadcrumbs of life that get us to where we are. But you said something interesting about your character and your makeup. Like, you're really good at selling, right? But part of what being an entrepreneur is, to your point, is problem solving. It's building something from idea to market. And as a salesperson, I would put myself in that same boat. We're hype men. We can sell the dream and the vision, but there's still so much that takes to get that product to market or that service to market. And again, in a technical space, which is where you come from with Stakester, and we'll get to Stakester later on, but especially in a technical space, unless you're a developer, you then have to sell the idea of bringing a technical co-founder on and all the other things that come with it. But as someone who is wired for sales, do you find it challenging to build a startup, because in your mind you're like, just get me the product and that we can go from there? And because again, from zero to launch, there are thousands of steps, sometimes thousands of days, definitely tens of thousands of dollars before you can get to the point where your strength can truly kick in. Do you find that to be challenging and frustrating for you?
Yeah, I'm gonna, you know, and James, this is your podcast, so how dare I, but I'm gonna challenge
you. Please, go ahead. No, challenge away, challenge away.
I'm gonna say, like, you're doing it from day one. Right, okay, so let me tell you the story about how I found my co-founder. Yeah, so when I came out with the idea for Stakester, and we'll mention that later, I'm not a product guy, I'm not a tech guy. You know, I just had an idea, and I was like, first of all, like, when you see that problem as a team builder, you see the problem, you're like, I need to find someone to fix that problem. And then that person, I don't have the money to pay that person. I've got to sell the dream of what we can create and the value of that to that person. And when you start out as a founder, there's three things you can sell, okay? Principally, you have to give someone a clear and believable path to how they can become incredibly wealthy. But it has to be in three areas. That first one is wealthy in experience. It's saying, look, you are going to have the experience of building something from scratch. And that, throughout history, people have always yearned for that. I want to build my own house. I want to build my own family. You know, I want to take from me from nothing to something. And that's intoxicating. You want to sell that dream to that person. The second thing is rich in notoriety. The truth is, if I said to you now, James, tell me all the people you know who are number 100 plus in the business. Yep. And you'll be like, I don't know any. Tell me the founders of some amazing businesses. And you'll be like, oh,
yep.
Here's a list of all of them. People remember the first ones. They always do. They remember the first person to run a 4-minute mile in a marathon, Roger Bannister. They remember the first person to go sub 9.6 in, and that's obviously sort of 9.6, Usain Bolt. You remember those people. You always remember the first. And so that notoriety will never leave you to be one of those founders. And the third, of course, is money. There is the opportunity there when you work in. And there's nothing wrong with being motivated by money, but it's something that comes with the success of a startup. And so for me, the first thing I did, I realized that I don't have that person. I don't have that technical co-founder I need. And so it's a funny story. So I'd figured out that esports was where I wanted to go. So I pick up the phone to a friend of mine, Monica, who's also one of my co-founders, said, Monica, hey, look, have you got any connections in the gaming space? Because this is what I want to create. I don't have anyone to do it with me. She goes, well, have you met my fiance? And I was like, oh, Monica, I don't want to meet your fiance. Yeah, okay, I don't want to meet him. She goes, he was one of the co-creators of Grand Theft Auto. oh, okay, all right. Well, what's he doing tomorrow night at 6 o'clock? What, do you want to do a call? And I'm like, no, I'm looking at Skyscanner now. I can be in New York tomorrow at 6 p.m. pre-COVID. So I jump on a plane, I fly over to New York, and that's a salesman in you. Like, if you're a sales guy, I want to meet you face-to-face. I want to see eye-to-eye. And so I sit down with Gary. He's British, so obviously he's incredibly intelligent. And I said to him, I said, look, Gary, this is my idea. And I told him, and he's there, and he's bolstering, he's rubbing his chin. He's like, he gives me a list of about 30 reasons why it's not going to work. And then he's like, but I'm in. And I'm like, yes, that's the story. But that's where the selling comes in. That's where you're pitching from day one, because you've got to find the people who can solve the problem.
Yeah.
And if you know how to pitch, and you know how to get people excited and bring that emotional contagion into the room, you're going to find great people who are going to solve those problems for you.
I don't want to do wrong by my audience. And so we've talked about Stakester a few times. So just so that my audience has a context for it, explain Stakester to everybody listening.
Let me create a scenario so it's really easy to understand. Did you play any esports? You play NFL?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, look, I'm better than you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to chuck in a tenner, you chuck in a tenner, and then the winner takes the pot. All right? Okay. That's literally what we do. We create a platform which allows people to play games of skill against their buddies, against people they don't know, and they just put in the money in. $10 in, winner takes the pot, and we facilitate that for them.
Is the game played on your platform?
No, the game's played on their platform. It's played on console. Yeah, predominantly on console, Xbox or PlayStation.
So if you and I want to play, we go into Stakester, we each put up our 10, and we go to play the game. Where does the release of that money come from? Both parties just being people of integrity? Is there...
So the money, so you put money into our product. So you submit the money in. And that's the whole thing around trust. And let me tell you the story about how, do you want to hear the story about how this started?
100%. Absolutely.
Okay, right. So I'm into my martial arts. I'm not particularly good, but I am into them. And I'm on the mat in the gym. I had some success previously, and I'm on the mat in the gym doing some jiu-jitsu. And this Russian guy walks in. And he's wearing a vest, and he's hench, and I'm not. And he's like, I recognize you. You're a win competition. And I know this accent's perfect because 100%. One of my investors is Russian, and he loves it. He goes, I recognize you. You're a win competition. And I was like, yeah, I did win a competition. Thank you. Not for jiu-jitsu, for something else. But anyway, it doesn't matter. And then all of my people around me are like, oh, don't do this. This guy's so arrogant. Shut up. Don't listen. Don't do this. But then he follows up, and he says, but you look so weak. And I was like, oh, all right, heartbreaking. I laughed and I said, yeah, well, cheers, mate. And he said, well, how about we spar sometime? And I was like, all right, who's this guy? I don't even know him. And he's challenging me to a duel. And I was like, okay, fine. And he goes, how about we put the money in? Anyway, so that and at the time, I didn't know this was a cultural thing for Russians. They like to play for money. So I agreed, but any of you listeners that are listening, you know, who've ever done any jiu-jitsu, they know that actually, like, just because you're big and strong doesn't mean you're going to win. Anyway, so he comes in, and don't want to go too technical, but basically I pull guard, I get him in a triangle, and then he taps out, right? Okay. And he gets the strop, and he's like, and he just goes off, and I'm like, whoa, where's my money? And he goes, I pay you next time. And I'm like, no, that's not how this works, buddy. You pay me now. And he goes, I have no cash. And so I'm like, well, I'm not giving this dude my bank details, so I'm trying to find an app on my phone. And then... the light bulb goes. This is culture. This is what we do. Like, James, you remember when you were a kid and you're playing pool with your buddies and you're like, yeah, let's raise the stakes on this. You used to do it all the time. And it might even be for beers. It might be for pizza. It could be for anything. Yeah, that's kind of disappeared now because we don't carry cash. And also, when it comes to esports, we're playing internationally. I'm not going to give some dude, I don't know, my bank details. Yeah. But I want the excitement of playing. Yeah, we call ourselves an entertainment business. All we're doing is we're not about gambling. You know, we don't believe in that. What we're here for is we're here to just add a little bit of spice to something you're already enjoying.
Absolutely love it. But how do you, back to you and I playing NFL online together, if I beat you, which is highly likely, you know, if we're doing that, what is the system in place that we come back into Stakester and just through integrity, I say, I won, you lost, and we report back and it's released?
So yeah, so there is that. So you go in and you say you did, but you take a photo. You take a photo of the winning screen, and then we have some AI in the background that reads it and then tells if you're talking smack or not.
So even if you decided my dog was distracting me, James got 2 touchdowns, that's how you won. If as long as I take a photo, your AI will recognize the win. So you couldn't be a poor sport and not report it. The AI will take care of it and release it.
Correct. Yeah. And we do have some contentions that, you know, of course we do like anything else, but they're below 0.1%. They're super low. And we always say, like, the reality of it is, like, people aren't there to make money. People are there to be entertained, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If it's $10, like, the most you can do is double your money, right? So people aren't really that fussed. It's not like, you know, so people are pretty well behaved. And yeah, we have a really low element of it. And also, look, we have a zero tolerance element to that. So if we find that someone's trying to hustle, we're just, mate, get off, go and play with someone else.
Yeah. Oh, love it. Now, you mentioned in telling of the story that you had previous success with other startups. What was your earlier startup that you had success with?
So I was really lucky. Well, let's say story actually about getting startups is always a funny one. I think any entrepreneur can relate to this. So I worked for a company that you'll know because you're in the US called Dun & Bradstreet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I had a senior role there and I was really blessed and I had a really great career and I was doing incredibly well. I got approached by a couple of guys who were like, hey, we're starting a company and we're looking for a guy to do the growth. Yeah. And I said to him, just let me understand this. Wait, so you're asking me to leave my incredibly well-paid job with a car and a pension and commission, and you want me to not get paid to work for your company? Dude, you're smoking crack.
Yeah.
So what's going on here? But like the idea was cool. And then I remember really vividly what happened. The guy in question, Vishal, like a real sensational guy, he said to me, the same thing as I said to you earlier, he said, Tom, can you remember any of the people that, you know, that worked at companies? Or can you remember people who founded those companies? And I was like, ah, you've got me.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's such a simple pitch. And yeah, I had a really great ride there. So I mistakenly called myself a founder for a long time. But actually, in reality, I wasn't really a founder. What I was I came in at like month three. Okay, so like I was a founding employee, I would say. Yeah, I took salary sacrifice. Yeah, I took the plunge and took the heat like everyone else. But I wasn't really a founder. I would say a founder is someone who came up with the idea and has stayed up late thinking, how am I going to make payroll? Do you know what I mean? That's it. You've got to feel that pain. And I hadn't really felt that pain. And so I was, we had great success. Like we were at like almost 200 employees in 2 years. We really smashed it. And, you know, my part of the business, we were selling to every big bank in the world. And that was great. But we had other people with us. There was eight of us in that founding team, effectively, of which, and so what I realized was, as I started to surround myself, I went on to the accelerators. I did the Microsoft Accelerator. I did one with PwC, Citi, and so forth. And I was surrounded by these other companies that really felt like startups.
Yeah.
You know, like they're wearing hoodies. They're on bean bags. They were, you know, they had cool merch and all this kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, man, I'm not really a founder. I'm part of a well-funded corporate. Like we had a lot of money that we weren't, we'd all put money in. We were super well-funded. It wasn't really the same as like a real core startup in the same way. Not taking away from these guys at all. They did an incredibly good job, but it's very different to what it's like. They're really a spin out of a previous business. I was addicted to the startup world. Once you get the bug, like, damn, you want to be part of it. So yeah, I'd had all the experience of what it'd been like to be in a hyper growth startup, but I wasn't really a founder. Okay. And then when you go on that founder journey, you realize actually how hard it really is.
It's interesting you mentioned that too, because, you know, a couple episodes ago, we had Matt Barnett, the founder of Bonjoro. And Bonjoro came to be because of a product that he helped develop out of a large enterprise. And they were seeing a different use case for it. And so he spun it out completely with no funding, though. Like he literally just said, hey, I want to take this to consumer side. He bought some of the technology off and spun it up. And he acknowledges like how different it is building something in a large enterprise where you have this massive financial backing to when the moment he took the technical solution outside of the enterprise to build it himself, he's like, it was a world of difference. It is night and day when it's your pocketbook trying to figure out how to sell it, how to build it, how to fundraise for it. When all that sits on your shoulders, it changes the game on how you move forward. And for a lot of people, they can't handle that. Like it's paralyzing to them. Like they're just too much. And I think the media has glamorized what it means to be a startup founder. The media has taken this idea that you have a great idea on a napkin, you apply to Y Combinator, and all of a sudden you're in there and you're going to be filthy stinking rich at some point because you're going to get so massively funded. That is not the journey. That's the anomaly. So what was it about you being around the startup scene that became so addicting for you, knowing that you are seeing success with this? And what was the name of that previous startup where you were seeing success?
Quantexa, Quantexa.
And what was the industry that was in?
Financial crime prevention.
Interesting. So I could see how you probably leveraged some of your learnings with Quantexa to Stakester. And again, back to the breadcrumbs of life, things just kind of play off of each other. So being in that environment where you are well-funded, you're seeing significant success and growth, what was it about the startup scene that was so appealing to you? All right, before we continue on with Tom's story, I just want to ask you, the Startup Story listener, a quick question. How valuable would it be to have direct access to some of my past guests to learn exactly how they executed certain strategies to grow their businesses? Well, that is the experience and knowledge sharing that is available to you in each quarterly box when you become a Grindology member. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter full of resources to help fuel your grind and your hustle. Now, what's included in your Grindology shipment, you might be asking? Well, each shipment delivers two bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, the hustler, the entrepreneur, the maker, and creator. Each shipment also includes an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. And lastly, and most importantly, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of the Grindology Tactical Manual, we will be delivering to you tactics and strategies you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive full marketing funnel strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies that they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that you will find in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. Everything about Grindology is about helping to fuel your grind. And that is why our friends at Design Pickle have partnered with us for our first shipment by hooking up one lucky subscriber with a full year of unlimited graphic design services. You can visit Grindology.com to learn more. Like I said earlier, we are shipping this box now, and it is an exclusive shipment, so make sure to secure your box today at Grindology.com. We'll include a link to Grindology.com within our show notes for easy access. Now let's get back to our episode. What was it about the startup scene that was so appealing to you?
First and foremost, it's the people, right? There is something about people who work or are attracted to startups. They're the most incredible people on the planet. You know, you think like I worked in super high caliber organizations with high caliber people who were really impressive. Mm. It's another level when you work with startups. The greatest people don't want to be told what to build. Yeah, they want to build it their own way. Yeah, that's the reality of it. It's like the greatest sportsmen of all time. They're the ones who just did it their own way. That's the reality. And I remember arriving at the Microsoft Accelerator after we got on. I walk in and so, you know, as a friend of mine, and that's one of my great friend, really tight. And I met him and it's just like, I just couldn't believe his knowledge about the world. You know about all these problems in all these banks and all these issues. You're like 27. it's mad. And then you meet other people and the ambition you find. I met a guy and he's like, yeah, we're building we're completely changing the payment solutions for banks. And I was like, what? And I was like, yeah, we're going up against people like Visa and MasterCard. You're going up against who? Yeah. Like this ambition. And I was like, God, I want to be part of this. Like all I'm doing is I'm replacing stuff that I've been replacing for my whole career. Like I'm just version 4.0 of the same thing that I'd already been doing, right? Do you know what I mean? I'm just adding a bit, whereas these guys are revolutionizing the space, taking it. And it's, and that's so intoxicating to meet those kind of people who have that ambition, but they have the talent and the drive to build it up. Also the resilience. Oh. Yeah, I always think resilience is such an attractive quality you see in people. We talk about resilience when you work in a corporate. And the fact of the matter is your job is only ever as safe as your notice period. That's the reality. Like it could change at any moment, right? But getting fired is hard. Failing at a startup is easy. It could happen to you. At the moment, as our business, we're very lucky. We've got like a year's runway, but we could start spending badly on adverts and they don't work out and we could not be here in 3 months.
It's amazing to me with the startup founders, like to your point, your second point about resilience, like the ambition is one thing. There's a lot of people that can have massive ambitions, but it's moving forward on the ambition despite all the people that tell you it's crazy. Like to your point, the people that are taking on Visa and MasterCard and their startup. And you look at these legacy brands, you're like, you're trying to accomplish what? Like I had just, a week or two ago, I had the founder of Brunt Workwear, who is trying to cater to the modern day tradesmen with boots and work clothes. And he's trying to take on the Dickies and the Carhartts and the Levi's. And he's trying to take on these massive legacy 100-year-old brands because they're not serving the modern day tradesmen. And at first I was like, that is crazy. But then when you hear him unpack why this problem needs to be solved, you're right. It's intoxicating. Oh, I can see why this is an opportunity that most people would overlook. You know, you go into this knowing the chances are highly in favor of you failing. If anybody is a realist, you know the data points and you are not going to succeed, but you continue to move forward up that hill because you believe that you're the exception to it and you just try to execute well. And I absolutely love every bit of it. You know, and so back to Stakester now, you know, having been around the successful growth startup, you know, that's well funded, having been around those who are building something from nothing, having had an encounter with a large Russian, and you start developing Stakester, again, to go from idea to product is where most people will either stop or they'll get discouraged by it, or they'll just kind of not even pursue it because they don't know how to connect the dots. And again, you're not a technical person. What was that first step for you? The moment the Russian, you beat the Russian and he wasn't paying up, what was the first step for you when it came to building and moving forward on Stakester?
I owe this actually credit for this to a guy who runs a fund now called Consilience Ventures. Shout out to a guy called Kevin Montserrat. He's a French guy, incredibly sexy. And he says, Thomas, you want us not to worry about the MVP. You worry about the MVV. And I'm like, the what? There's a minimum viable value. And I was like, wow. I was like, what is that? He said, look, you need to worry about what is the minimum value that you can give to your customers in order that they will pay for your service. Okay, that's it. Right? What's the minimum value? Don't worry about MVP. And so I started at the bottom. I was like, answer those questions. What is the minimum value I need to offer to my customers? What is it? And also, what are they getting out of it? And I'm very much, I use the tree model of thinking. Yeah. And so what I do is I start off and I really understand that trunk first, where I just really get into that. What is that value? I don't move away from it. That's where I focus. And then it starts to peter off and it's like, okay, how can I show this? How can I show that? How can I win it from this person? Which audience do I go to? But you've got to focus first and foremost, more than anything, on that value you give to your customers. And if you focus on that relentlessly, everything else becomes easy. As you bring it back to that, the mistake that founders make, and I coach a few founders and I invest, is that they get distracted from their original cause. You know, when you think about the best products in the world, people like Uber, the minimum viable value for Uber, the minimum thing I get from there is, does it allow me to order a cab on my phone? That's all I need to know.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? Airbnb, can I book a room on my phone? Yeah, that's all you need to provide. And then everything else comes from there. So that's what I did. So I just figured that out. And then I just started mapping out that journey, being like, where, how do I get my customer from here to there? And then you start looking at needs and problems. You're like, okay, right, fine. I need to have an audience of this size in order to provide this. I need to have this game because of this. The next thing you do, which is I really believe in, is you've got to plan that team out. The one hack I would say to everyone is write down everything that you need to happen in your business and try as best you can to make sure your name is next to none of them.
Interesting.
Okay? Because you aren't good enough at it. As a founder, you need to be good at three things: pitching to investors, pitching to employees, and making sure everyone knows what the strategy is. That's all you got to do.
Would you say that's from a day one founder position?
God, it's a tough question, that one, isn't it? It's a tough one. It depends on your situation. I think from day one, you should be thinking about how you can hire people better than yourself.
Yeah,
you got to have real self-awareness. Know what you're the best in the world at, and then hire people who are the best in the world at the other things. For me, it's easy because I'm rubbish at everything. I'm not good at marketing. I'm not good at product. I'm not good at design. I'm not good at operations. It was easy. Like, awesome. It's just like, I need someone for all of this. And one tip I say to everyone is, never underestimate how much people will do for you, without being paid. It doesn't mean they're doing it for free. Mm. They are getting something out of it, whether it be equity, whatever it is, whether it be experience, whatever. But it's not about pay for a lot of people. People just want to be part of your journey. So involve people. And it's amazing what people will do.
Do you think the ship has sailed on the idea of having technical co-founders or technical partners that will do it for equity only?
No.
You still think there are developers out there that will do it? And the reason I asked that question, because the percentage of failure is so high, and from a developer perspective, your controls over the success truly are product only. And so I hear from a lot of co-founders how challenging it is to find a technical co-founder that is willing to do it with the same amount of risk that the primary co-founder is having it with, nothing.
Okay, so no, I don't think that's the case. I think the reality of it is it comes down to your role as the first founder is to create a clear and believable path to how others in your organization can become wealthy. People will work for you just for equity, but it's not just about equity. It's not about that. Equity is the mechanism by which they get rewarded financially at the end, provided you are selling someone the journey and the experience that they're going to have with you, the notoriety they're going to gain. Then people are working for that. If you are working, finding a co-founder, and it's just a transaction, it says, right, okay, I'm going to pay you in equity. That's a different conversation. People want to be part of something successful. Okay, people want that. I remember talking back to how I was, you know, when I was a kid, like I just wanted to be around the best teams. I wanted to be around the most talented people because it's intoxicating to feel that you're part of that. And if you can articulate that to people and they can genuinely feel that you're going to create something that's going to change the world and be the best of what they do, you'll be knocking them away. I genuinely believe that. And I've seen it happen. I've experienced it happen. And that's your role as a founder, to be able to articulate that. And people can smell when you don't believe in it. If you don't believe in what you're going to do, then why would anyone take the risk to come and work for you?
Absolutely. You have got to absolutely believe it to the very core in order for people to come on board. You know, one of the things that that I found interesting about what you said earlier about the three core strengths that a primary founder has to have is, you know, the ability to rally those, you know, to secure those people around you that are better than you, the ability to pitch investors, and then the ability to communicate your vision to your team so that they're constantly on board with it. From your growth in Stakester, when you think back to how you began in your early days, keeping a focus on those three was obviously critical to where you are today. But how did you balance the messaging across those three sectors? Because they're different audiences.
Do you know what? It's hard, James. Like, it's a hard thing to do. The strategy is start with the people internally. The strategy wants the people in the business. That's not actually as easy as people think it is. People are like, oh, clear strategy. It's not that easy. Because everyone in your business will see things that they think are more valuable. They think that the work they do is more valuable. They think it's more valuable than someone else in the organization. They might have a different vision for where your business is going. And it might be that their vision is better than the others. It might be better. It might be a better route. But if you don't have everyone in that ship trying to go the same direction, you're going to fail. Okay, whether or not that might be the best or not, you've just got to take that hit. And you've got to, your role as a CEO is to choose what that vision is. Whether you can take as much information as you want from lots of people to make that decision. But you have to make that decision. You've got to make sure everyone is going in that direction. And we've made that mistake at Stakester, where we've been moving slightly different ways. Yeah. And then it's taken us off a course and we've had to come back on. But that's your job, because you are literally, as the phrase says, at the helm of that ship. And you've got to make sure you stay true to that course. And if you don't, you'll waste time and then competitors come in and you fail. And I believe that happens a lot.
100%. Absolutely. 100%. So let's talk about the investor side of things, the funding side of things. Now, you've had success. Again, you've had success along the way. And I think for those listening, they might inherently think, oh, well, he probably just self-funded everything from the get-go. You know, what was your funding strategy and the tactics you employed early on to get to your... First of all, let me back up. Let me just remove some assumptions real quick. Have you had... What rounds of funding have you gone through? Friends and family? Angel? Series A?
So no friends and family yet. So at the very, very beginning, and I'm completely transparent about this, I funded two things, okay? So I funded basic setup, so like domain name, Gmail, basic stuff like that. Okay, I funded that at the very beginning. But everyone who worked for me at the beginning, they took salary sacrifice. They bought equity in my business through salary sacrifice, okay? They did. Everyone who came on at the beginning did that. And I'm very proud of that because it shows the faith they had. But I also paid for our first legal opinion, okay? I wanted to make sure that what we were doing wasn't considered gambling because I wanted to be able, because I don't believe it is, but I'm not a legal expert. So I went to the biggest law firm in the UK to get that signed off because it's an important part of what we were doing. And I funded that myself, okay? And that's not a small amount of money. So I accept that. I say to people at the time, that was it. But in terms of the operation of the business, I couldn't afford to fund that. I only had so much money. So I had to start raising straight away, okay? And my first round was a pre-seed where we raised $500,000bucks. Now, that was not easy. And I had learned a really serious lesson there, which I'm happy to share. So day one, I've already got connections in the industry because I went on the accelerator. I've got some cool connects. I know some cool people. And the first thing I do on day one is I go out and I'm like, I try and get myself some big name investors. So I pitched myself out. I pitched them. And I'll be honest, there's no easy way to say this, but I messed it up. Because I'm good at pitching, but I didn't know what they wanted to hear. Rather than I know what, but I didn't know how to articulate the value of what I was doing in a way that meant that they were going to invest. So I go into conversations with conservative numbers. They don't want to hear conservative numbers. They want to hear you're going to be a unicorn. Yeah. You know what I mean? They don't want to hear sensational, but they don't want to hear that. You didn't do it. I was going in there and I was like, no, I don't need this, I don't need that. And they're like, well, no, we want you to need this and that because we want you to be dependent on us for money.
Yes.
Do you mean it's like, don't tell me you're going to be profitable after 6 months. That means you're not spending enough. All these silly mistakes that I made because I didn't know. And I failed with some really amazing potential VCs for us. And I moved too soon. But I needed money and I went to VCs when I should have really gone to angels. And I learned that lesson. And I remember this so vividly. I was walking along Oxford Street in London and I just got out of my gym and I was walking to go back to where I had a co-work. And on the space of the journey, and James, this is about 25 minute walk, I received 3 rejections from payment providers, okay, who said, we can't work with you because we think you're gambling. Ironically, one of them now works with us. I got 2 rejections from some investors on the same journey. As you know, as a coffee connoisseur, you know how much, you can tell how emotional I was. I went into Starbucks for a coffee.
You were in a dark place, my friend.
I was in a dark place. So I went to Starbucks. And I sat down at the table there and I was like, I can't go back to the office. Because I don't think we're going to make it. I was like, I think I'm done. I was like, maybe this isn't what it needs to be. And it was really hard. And I think I messaged a friend of mine and I said to her, look, this is probably not going to work out. She said, come meet me for coffee and you're just getting your pitch wrong. Come and practice your pitch with me. Yeah. So I went for a coffee, and this is a true story. I went to have a coffee with her up in Belsize Park in London, near where I lived in Hampstead, and I'm pitching to her and her husband in the coffee shop. And this guy called Scott walks past, he gives me his card, and he says, hey, look, do you mind if I give you my card? Because I really like what you're doing and I think I'd like to invest.
That's awesome.
That's real. Now, he didn't actually invest in it again. His colleague, Steve, did, his boss. First ever money that we took for the business came from someone overhearing me at a coffee shop. And then we get our money in and it wasn't a lot. It was enough to give us a little bit of a stay. And then I realized at that point, when I met that guy, I was like, these are the people that I should be selling to.
Real quick, when you say these are the people, I'm really big on words. And so I don't want to skip over that. These are the people. Define these.
Yeah, so what I was doing, I was selling to VCs too early. I didn't have enough. The people talk about VCs, the reality of it is when they say they're risk takers, they're not really risk takers. What they are is they find a model that they like the fit of and they follow that model. Okay, I like to invest in these types of businesses, these types of people. And the reality of it is you find the number of people who are first-time founders that are invested in by VCs. Yeah, it's, that's the reality. And I was really a first-time founder and I wasn't the right fit at that stage. It was too risky. And I'm, and I get that, but now I am VC backed, but we'll come to that later. And so what I did was, I was like, no, I need to find angel investors. People who, I'm an angel investor now. I would say angel investing is just a very tax efficient way of losing your money. because we're there to take risks because we know the risks. We know that money's probably going to disappear. But if it doesn't, we do incredibly well out of it. Yeah. That's who, and I was like, this is who I should be selling to. Because I'm at that stage, I'm at angel stage, but no one educated me about this stage that it was. And that's the people I wanted to find. So what I did was I said, right, here's my guy. Here's my guy, Steve, okay? Steve, investment banker, here's his age bracket. So I went out and I was like, okay, right, I've got a guy who used to create lists for me. So Naz, go and build me a list of these types of people from LinkedIn and get me their email addresses. I got the list, I put it together. I wrote an email. I wrote a cold email. I used GMAS. I highly recommend it to anyone. And I sent an email out to 1,000 people.
You sent a cold email out to 1,000 people and that became your angel round.
My angel round was £500,000. Okay. And £400,000 of it came from that email.
Oh my. Well, so obviously you know something about a cold pitch. In my head, I'm believing you because I do believe you. But at the same time, there's a part of me that's like, cold emails for investment? Cold emails for a lot of other things. I just can't wrap my head around it for investment. I think there's probably a lot of other people that are pausing as well, thinking there's no way that works. You're proof of it. Can you unpack this cold pitch?
I will read you the email if you like.
That would be incredible. If you could read the email and then kind of talk us through, for everyone listening, considerations for a successful cold email.
If you want to raise money, or you basically just generally in cold email, the rule is really simple. It is absolutely fine to send a cold email to someone, provided what you're saying is interesting. It's simple as that. If someone sends me something and they say, Tom, look, I think I can reduce your payment fees by 3%. I'm like, all right, I'll listen to you. If someone says to me, Tom, I can do app development for you in X country. I'm like, oh God, another one. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's like, Tom, I can rebuild your website. Yeah, all right. You've got to make it interesting. You've got to make it relevant. Okay, so that comes down to targeting. Make sure you're sending it to the right people and make sure it's interesting. There is a three-step rule that I always say to people whenever they are writing the email. Number one, make it interesting. Number two, make it credible. Show that you are worth listening to. Add some credibility in there. We've already worked with X company. Yeah, or I worked at X company before. Or here's an interesting piece of information for you. To add credibility to this. And third, make the call to action very clear. You are not selling in that email. You are selling a conversation in that email. Don't say to me, would you like to invest in that email? Say, would you like a conversation? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're saying that we did actually get $25,000 off the email alone. But okay, so let me read you the exact email that I sent out that raised me that much money. Hey, so-and-so, I'll be brief. I'm the founder of X. We enable X to do X, and we're seeing solid early traction. I previously worked for X, and my co-founder was X at X and Y. We launched our product last month and we already have X many downloads. We've raised so much so far and I'm reaching out to you as a potential investor because of this, this and this. The funds are being used to further develop the product and for customer acquisition. I've attached my deck for your review. It'd be great to have a hangout or a discussion to talk about this further if it's of interest. All the best, Tom. That's it.
And that was the formula you used to raise close to $400,000 of your $500,000 round.
That is correct. £500,000, so like $650.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And now from that though, what was the time span, if you could remember, from sending email to closing out that $400,000? How long was that process?
So the article I just read to you, I wrote that article when I'd raised £250,000. Okay. But then the money kept coming in. So total, it took me 9 months to raise £500,000. And we did a rolling round. We did it on notes. I think you called it safe in the US, and we called it an ASA here.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Absolutely love that. So it took you 9 months to close your half million. Was there a follow-on round for anything?
Because we're doing a rolling round, we're going along, we're trickling along, and with that money, just to keep us alive and get us to the point where we would say that we wanted to raise that money to get us to the point where the product was really out there, right? The MVP.
Yeah.
Okay, we had enough traction to say, yeah, here's some really early signs of product market fit, and then we do a venture round. Now, throughout that process, plug here, I run a podcast in the UK called The Back Yourself Show, where I interview VCs and founders about practical tips. And I'd met a lot of VCs along the way. And also, I'd also met with some VCs as I'd been introduced by other angels. Because what happens is when you bring on angels, by the way, my top fundraising hack for anyone raising money is find a super angel. Okay, and a super angel is someone who will connect you with other people. I have two, and they're both former MDs of Techstars. And the value those people bring is insane because they know everyone. They've seen everything. They connect you with the right people. And it means your next round is super easy. So I spent 9 months raising £500,000. 9 months. You won't believe this, but it took me 2 weeks to raise £2 million.
Oh my goodness. Were these super angels part of your initial round and therefore that second round became easier?
No, they weren't. They were completely new. What I did was, there's a book called it's by Robert Cialdini. It's called The Six Principles of Persuasion. And one of the key reasons that motivates people to do things is obviously scarcity is a big part of it.
Yeah.
I spoke to these people and I was like, look, I don't want to keep raising money. It's taking too long. All right. It's the end of the summer. I want the money in. So I spoke to everyone. I said, right, guys, I'm running around. It's 3 weeks. Here's my traction. Our traction was good. And they were like, oh God. And then I said, what I did was, but I did that because I knew that I had one offer that was coming in. I knew it was coming. So I phoned out a company and said, look, I spoke to you earlier on. You said you wanted to be involved when I was a little bit further around. I'll tell you what. And ironically, we didn't end up taking their money. I said to them, look, do you want to be involved in this round? If you do, get me a term sheet. You've got 3 weeks. That term sheet came in. I just started running around all the VCs being like, check this out. Yep. And I remember specifically where I was. I was in my camper van driving across Scotland through a place called Glencoe, which basically looks like something out of Lord of the Rings. And I'm on the phone to this fund. I've got them all up there as I'm tethering in the back of my camper. And I say to them, look, guys, they're like, yeah, they're Russian. They're like, we need to go away and we need to talk about it. I said, guys, if you need to go away and talk about it, we probably haven't got a deal because you've got until about 6 o'clock tonight because otherwise I'm going to accept this other offer. They came back at 5:30 and we cut a deal. And it was great. That's, it's great. That's the awesome thing. You've got to bear in mind that. I say this is so interesting, actually. Everyone wants to live their life like they're in a movie. So you've got to create an opportunity for them to do it. Everyone loves moving fast. Everyone likes feeling like they've got that Hollywood moment. At the same time, I know my fund, they talk about that story as much as I do. They're like, yeah, we close the deal in 2 weeks. They love it. They want to be part of it.
Yeah. Yep.
The due diligence took a long time. But the process of like, meet me again, let's cut a deal, was fast enough. They say, look here, and that's what people want to be. No one wants to sit around waiting. So if your VC says to you, look, it's going to take this much time to do it, say, okay, fine. Yeah, you might miss out on this one.
Absolutely love that. Especially from a sales strategy perspective, because again, you're great at sales, right? The best salesperson is the one that is willing to walk from the deal. There's no posture of desperation that comes from it. You had a deal you were ready to take anyways. It's such a healthy place to start negotiating from. So I love that you're able to do that.
I think a big thing, I learned a valuable lesson from a guy called Eamon Carey, who is he's the MD of Techstars in the UK and he runs the fund in the UK. And he said, Tom, look, make yourself someone that someone wants to work with. They want to be part of something cool. It's not just about, like you think about how many fintechs or how many CTOs go into people or technical founders go into meetings and they're like, we have a great deal. You know, it's like, and they're like, oh God, I've heard the same thing, same slides every time. Every time you go in there, they hear the same things all the time. I want people to enjoy working with me.
Yeah.
So the first thing I say to people when I pitch, I'm like, what are you better than me at sport-wise? All right, and they'll be like, what? And I'm like, what are you better than me at? Because that's what my app's all about. So if you're gonna join, I need to know that I'm gonna fight you.
That's awesome.
And they remember that. So everyone's got a way of differentiating yourself. Don't be the other person that was involved. Don't be the vanilla flavor in that day. Be the one they remember.
Yeah. Well, we had Marco Zappacosta, the founder of Thumbtack. They've had 7 rounds of funding, over $400 million. And one of the things that he talks about in this episode is fundraising is storytelling. Everyone focuses so much on the data points, and the data points will come at some point when they're really interested, but it starts with the storytelling. They've got to place themselves within the problem you're trying to solve. That's incredible. And what you said is just that. What sport are you better than me at? You're placing them into the problem you're trying to solve. Absolutely love it. So when did you close that 2 million? Let's put a date stamp on that.
November.
So it has been 2-3 months up to that point. Where is the product right now? Is it in market?
Right. So we're in market. We're out there. We're doing great. We've got great traction. We've got like 20,000 active users, which is amazing. We're doing really well. Our users are vehemently passionate about what we do and they love it and they help us. We're launching, but we're still at MVP, right? Okay. We're still there. And really simply, people say to me, like, what's this? It's quite an interesting story. People say to me, what's that money for? Okay, what are you doing with that money? Now we're in a new market. And I said, look, that money takes me to being number one globally. Okay, that's what it does. It makes me number one. And I'm going to be number one by about May in terms of traction.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's what that money was going to take me. And so we're MVP, but our version one goes live on February the 17th. That's our version one. New face, new features, new cool stuff, but the concept's the same. We're growing at a crazy rate. We stopped. It's so funny. When that money comes in, let me tell you this. November 1st, I have 9 employees. December 1st, I have 22.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I started hiring them before I had the money. Because I was like, I'm getting this money. I can't afford to cover it if they don't. But I mean, pulling out. Yeah. So I was like, but I know I'm getting this. I'm closing this deal. So I started hiring because the last thing you want to do is be in a situation where you get the money and then it takes you 3 months to get the talent.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes a long time to hire people, right? And so we planned ahead and we got there and we just gave people conditional offers.
It's interesting, the place you're in, right? The idea of being number one in May, you have 20,000 active users now. From the outside in, I'm looking at, okay, who's his persona? His persona are obviously people that are gamers, they're video game people, but not all video game people are willing to put money on the line for their video game. How do you identify your persona And then how big is that space? Because gaming is massive. We can all agree gaming is just a huge sector to serve. But your, and correct me if I'm wrong, your persona is not just the gamer. There's a niche inside of the gaming community that is your persona. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So knowing that your persona is a niche of a larger segment, how critical was that for you to be crystal clear on in order to see the growth that you're seeing?
A problem I see a lot of startups make, and we made it as well at the beginning, is misunderstanding what you actually give to your customer. So let me explain that to you. You're giving your customer an emotion. Okay, a lot of the time, if you're B2C, right? Okay, so I use Xero, the fasting product. Okay, right, I love it. It helps track my fast. What they're selling me there actually is, I guess, it's kind of hope, right? It's like hope that I'm going to be in better shape. Hope that I'm going to improve my longevity. Hope, that's what they sell. And so they tell you about it all the time. They tell you about it all the time. They tell you about this is what's going to happen. This is where you're going to get to. And that's great selling. They get my personality. Yeah. Whereas you might think, that because it's a healthcare app, you're selling to gym bunnies or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the mistake they would make if they were trying to sell to the wrong people. And so what I said, and I remember when we were at Quantexa, a mistake we made was that we were trying to sell to people who were trying to fix the problem. Okay, that we're selling to. Actually, that's the wrong person because they don't like you. Don't come in here and tell me how to do my job. Yeah. Sell to the person above them who has to pay for them to fix the problem, and then you show them, you're going to save some money.
Yeah,
that's basic sales 101. So what we've done is we've been on a journey where we just ask people all the time, the best hack you can ever have as a startup or any business ever, talk to your customers.
Yes, yes.
But don't go into that discussion with a hypothesis. That's a mistake that people make.
Interesting.
Yeah, they go in and think, I think they're going to say this. Don't do that. Wipe the slate clean. Go in there and just listen to them. Let them talk. Let them tell you what the problem is. Let them tell you why they like your product. Don't say, oh, do you like this? Do you like that? No, just let them talk. And if you give people the opportunity to talk, you learn so much more. And we stumbled across something, which is why we think we're growing faster than everyone else. And I don't want to tell you what it is because I don't want those competitors knowing.
I understand.
Yeah, come around my house and talk to me. But the reality of it is, I think like, we figured out that actually what we're selling here isn't what people think we're selling. And it's revolutionized our business. Everything we do revolves around that. But you only learn that from speaking to your customers. And not only that, but letting them talk.
I love it.
Anyone can lead them down a path.
I love it. Absolutely love it. So, you know, we talk about being number one by May. If we were having a Where Are They Now episode in, let's say, 3 years, where do you see Stakester 3 years from now? What does the roadmap look like?
People talk all the time about exit, okay? I think exit is a really bad attitude to have. Don't build something with the intention of getting rid of it. Build something that you love and then people will want it. It's the same with houses. Like, I buy a house, I live in that house, I make it a house that I love and I want to live in. And then when people come to see it, they're like, I want to live in this house because you created something that people are going to love. And if you love it, someone else is probably going to love it as well.
Yeah.
And so what my ambition is to make the business that all of my customers love using. My employees love working there. And if my investors love the growth, that's great.
Yeah.
But principally, like, that's what you want to make it somewhere where everyone loves working and they are going to give you their best versions of themselves and give you the best output. Make it a product that your customers love and they're going to keep coming back and spending more money. Don't just keep thinking about that alpha. Don't keep thinking about how I'm going to sell this and how I make this marketable. That's in your mind. It could happen. It'd be great if it did. But I can tell you now, I'll be much happier having a business where I go every day and I love everyone I work with. I love what I do. I love my customers love me much more than I'm going to enjoy getting a big check. Because all I'm going to do with that big check is just do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's so rich. I absolutely love it. You know, I want to honor your time. I want to honor the time of my listeners. This has been an amazing conversation. I feel like we continue to just go and unpack some of the learnings that you've had. But you've given us so much value in this episode. And I'm so thankful for it. But there are three questions that I ask every founder as we wrap up. And I know our audience looks forward to it because I get the feedback all the time. And that first one is just really about your perspective on entrepreneurship. There's this idea that entrepreneurship is a field of dreams model. You build it and they will come. Like, it really is just a matter of, hey, have an idea, do a little bit of execution, raise some money, and keep going. There's so much about entrepreneurship that's not spoken about as far as the mental makeup, the resilience that we speak of. Do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur, or is it something that you are born with?
I say it's a really simple test to whether you're an entrepreneur or not. When things are going tough in anything, whether it's a sport, when you're running and you're tired, do you stop? If you are at home and you are trying to tidy up your house and you're like, oh, you know what, I'll do this later, do you press snooze on your phone in the morning? Yep. If you're that person, if something gets tough and then you use it, that's absolutely fine. Don't become an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur is someone who, when things suck and they really hurt, they're like, yeah, this is fuel for me. Yeah, this is what I want. I say this all the time. I love it when we hit a hurdle because someone else quit.
Yeah.
The best entrepreneurs are the ones that they just don't give up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what I truly believe. And that's the test. So think to yourself, when it's cold outside, do I decide not to go to the coffee shop? Yeah.
I love it. Let me ask this question, though, very specifically for you. When you look back on those hurdles that you're grateful for, you're thankful for, what is the singular hardest chapter of your life that you're so thankful for now?
In business or life?
Either. They both shape us.
I'm not naturally good at anything. Okay? Nothing. Every time I've done anything for the first time, I've been rubbish.
Yeah.
And I know that. And I'm accepting of that. I have no natural talent in anything. And what that's given me is a necessity to work if I want to be more than just what God gave me. If I want to be able to move up and become what I can, I'm very lucky that I am rubbish at everything naturally, because it means I work hard and I build an ethic which allows me to become better. And so every time I start anything new and I am rubbish at everything, that's a real blessing. Yeah. So to all those people out there who don't feel like they're talented, don't feel like they've got good genes, I don't have any of those things. I have to work at everything, and I'm doing all right.
Oh, I love that perspective. That's so good. You know, and it leads me to my next question that I ask your founder. It's about gratitude. You know, again, there's this idea with entrepreneurship that it is much about you just crashing on a friend's couch with front of a laptop, bringing product to market. Like, it's an isolated journey. It's just a lone ranger type adventure that we go on. And that's not true. And there might be those stories of success that along that route, but they're an anomaly, not the norm. So when you look back on your entrepreneurial journey, you know, your entire life, who are the people that you point to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you are today?
I say, first of all, I hate the phrase when everyone says to you, self-made, I'm like, shut up.
Yep, absolutely.
No, I'm not. Okay, first of all, you know, I'm a man of faith. God came here first, gave it to me first. And also, I'm not self-made. How disrespectful is that to my parents, for a start? They didn't give me money, but they raised me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So never, anyone says they're self-made, that's not true. Your support network is the most important thing you have when you're a founder. To the mother of my kids, you know, she looks after my children for me when I'm not there. To my friends who tease me and say that I'm an idiot. To my mates in the gym who let me spar with them to get rid of my stress. To my network, those are things outside of work which you need that release. People who just don't, my parents couldn't care less about, my mom doesn't even know what I do. If I asked mum what's the name of my company, she'd be like, what? Like, it's brilliant. But that gives you reality, it gives you a check, gives you escapism. And then you have the network of people. There is the thing about startups which you will never understand until you're in it, is how helpful everyone is. People like yourself creating amazing content for people so they can learn all the time. Every one of your episodes has some great learnings on which should make people better. People like every investor that you work with, they may not give you money, but they might give you wisdom.
Yeah.
Ask people for help and people will help you, and vice versa. By the way, to all the startup founders out there, don't be the guy that won't help other people out.
Yes. Yes. Oh my goodness. If there was any bumper sticker I could have for entrepreneurship, don't be that guy. Like, don't be that guy. Give back always. Oh my God. Because there are, again, no matter, and even no matter what stage you're in entrepreneurship, you have learned something that someone else needs to learn. And you can accelerate that by just sharing your knowledge. Oh, that was so good. Lastly, as our time comes to an end, I'm so thankful that you afforded me the extra minutes as our time recording. But I would love to provide an opportunity for all of my listeners to have these one-on-one conversations with my founders, but it's just not doable. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to afford this mentoring minute where it's just you and one of my listeners. And maybe it's the entrepreneur that is just frustrated with their lack of traction. They've been at this, but they continue to just grind and grind and grind, and they're not seeing anything cracked where there's a scaling or massive success that they hope for. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur who has a 9-to-5 and a book full of dreams and ideas, and there's some narrative, whether it be because they think they're too old, because most entrepreneurs tend to be younger. Maybe it's the mortgage and the family burden, or whatever the case may be. There's something as to why they don't move forward. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur that got kicked in the gut because of COVID, lost everything, and isn't quite sure they want to go through it again. If you were having coffee with one of those personas, one of my listeners in those categories, what would you say to that one person?
If you are in a situation where you don't think you can afford to start a company because the risk is too great, just do something. Whether that be write a mission statement, okay? Whether that be draw out a product plan, whether that be just go and speak to someone about your idea. Because as long as you're doing something, you're moving it forward. And then do something else, and then do something else. And before you know it, you've got something. And sooner or later, you will find a way to monetize it, and then you'll be able to make that jump. The worst thing you can do is do nothing.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Tom Ferry brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the startup story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. And Tom is a master connector and would love to connect with each of you on LinkedIn. So just search for Thomas Ferry on LinkedIn and reach out to him. And that's Thomas, and Ferry is Fairey. We'll always include a link in the show notes. But another great way to connect with him is to queue up his podcast, The Back Yourself Show, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And much like his profile on LinkedIn, we'll include a link to the show in our show notes as well for easy access. You know, I say it in every episode because I believe it with my very being. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs, so let's show up for Tom Ferry in a huge way as a way of saying thank you for all the value he delivered to us today. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at StartupStory_. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.